You are listening to a sermon series from Open Door Fellowship Church.
I think because of the sin done against me in my childhood, and because of the effects of that sin, and then those sins that I've committed, or that I've done against others, the shame was so big that I truly had the belief that there's something deeply wrong with me. I'm a rotten apple. And fears that came from growing up in poverty, being neglected, drove me to the depths of depravity to protect myself. So those fears stayed with me, even though the first step at 18 of turning to God and saying, if you're real, will you take care of me? Will you be my father? Is this real? Do you really love me? Then I'll stay with you. But I'm so weak and so fragile that the only way I can live this life is clinging to you. It's taken a long time to believe that I am who he says that I am. And because I didn't believe that, I hid my past. As God was prompting me to be honest about what he's done in my life, I was terrified. But what God kept telling me is that because I'm not sharing, then he is not glorified for what he's done for me. Without them knowing my story, then I take credit for that. And it has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with God going into those depths of depravity and scooping me up and saying, you are precious and I'm gonna save you. Because of his great love for me, I was able to believe that it would be okay. Even though I knew that it would have a lot of hard ramifications to tell the truth about myself. But because I'm amongst a community that supports me, supports my husband, I took the leap of faith and I wanted to run away. I wanted to hide again. I had to hold on to God's hand every day. And what that's done is that I'm not hiding beneath a facade. When I believe that he truly loves me, then I have confidence that whatever happens, if it's bad or good, is under his control completely. Down the road, fast forward, when John was talking about living life abundant, I thought, how can that be that I live life abundant? Like, what I do, I do have peace. I do. How can that be? I used to be plagued with anxiety. Perfect love drives out fear, and I really can have life abundant, even when things don't look good on the surface. Frequently, I have to go back to his word and re-believe. I still have to cling to God in order to know that truth and then to live my life in that truth.
Yay. Isn't it great to have the Walheims back? Yeah. They moved and left us, abandoned us, and went up to a place in Oregon, a godforsaken, pitiful place that they had. And they came back here to get more, come to a land that had more rain. And so that was us. And we're just glad they're back. And there's going to be a trade involving one of us that has to go up there. So the elders are working on that right now. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So great to be here. This series, next week, we're going to, let me just explain where we've been. We're doing this series that I'm going to kind of lay out that anthem again in a moment, but the first week was kind of a preamble, and then Jeff Young last week with his 14 children, he spoke. And then today is kind of a question of, what would it take, and it's the character of God, what would it take for me to start to risk faith that was beyond an anthem or a creed, but an active expression of my life. Then next week, I'm going to ask the question, okay, well, then how, God, would I know what it is that you want me to do? And that's going to be the first leg of our journey of walking into this whole subject of I believe. I wrote today, I believe in the character of God, which frees dangerous faith. I believe in the character of God. And that has freed, when I do, dangerous faith. Hebrews 11:1 says, now faith, this word pistos, this active, moving, living, breathing reality, this organism, faith, it is the assurance of things that I'm hoping for and the convictions of things that I don't see yet. Our God is supernatural. He's still doing the supernatural as much as any time in history. He's given us the astonishing privilege of manifesting His glory on this earth. The world is transformed always in some measure whenever I find myself risking the dangerous consequences of trusting His character to choose an act of love I otherwise would have ignored. And this frightens darkness in high places. Often, we're just guessing with no direct promise or verse to guide these specific choices, only a sense in our new hearts that this is right and true and worth doing, and coupled often with only a moment of God prodding my heart, saying, yes, this. Even if the outcome is not what we imagined or appears to fail, or if we experience loss, it is impossible for us to lose. There's only one possibility of loss. If we can be convinced that God is not trustworthy of risking to give our lives away, and we instead opt for safety, self-protection, vanity, or self-promotion. And we've probably spoken too little about this. I know I've probably spoken too little about this. It is as dangerous a subject to talk about as we have. It's elusive. We can't pin it down. We can't lock it down. We're going to say sentences that people, no, wait, what about the... This is a tough one. It's beautiful, you guys. This is abundant life now. A faith reduced to formulas and creeds or holding to universal promises of eternity. If that's all I've got, it is very little faith at all. Remember what we're doing. We don't know how else to do it. Remember what it says in Romans. I want to come so that I could be encouraged together while I'm with you, each of us by the other's faith, both yours and mine. I want your faith to encourage me, and I want my faith to encourage you. There's something particular and unique about each other. You have the power to strengthen, encourage, build up, and heal my faith. It's an incredible gift that I'm giving and that you're given. In 1 Thessalonians, that's why they said, we sent Timothy, our brother, and God's fellow worker in the gospel of Christ for this purpose, to strengthen and to encourage you as to your faith. And then he goes on in 5:11, so he says, therefore, all the time, encourage one another and build one another up in your faith, just as you're doing. And the way we're going to do that, you saw Deanna up there today. Each week we're going to try to have somebody in our body doing the best they can to express, this was one of those faith moments. This is one of those times where I found myself daring to risk that which I didn't know how it would turn out. And what we'd love you also to do, we don't have another way to do this, but for you to write on this email, stories@odfchurch.org. And you write there, and all we're asking is for you to write, this is a time in my life when I risked faith. I didn't know how it was going to turn out. I wasn't even sure why I was doing it, but I knew kind of that God wanted me to do it, and I thought it was right, and I acted by faith, and I tried this. I didn't have enough money for it, or I didn't know how it would turn out, but this is what happened. And when you share that with us, we get blessed, we get encouraged, we get strengthened, we get built up. So it comes right to Julie's desk and to Sam's desk and to my desk. It comes right to my computer, and I get to see these incredibly beautiful notes of faith. Some of them we will trim down to a paragraph and read on Sunday morning. Some of them we will put online. Some of them we won't use at all. But guys, this is our way of communicating with each other, of standing with each other, of loving each other, of protecting each other in our faith. So I sure hope you'll do that. When God wants to talk about me expressing this very thing that we're trying to describe, this faith that is beyond creed into action, where I find myself giving my life away, he speaks often of the word talent. Not skill, but a talent, a provision. It's usually in the form of money when you see it in the parables and the Gospels. Talent is spoken of as a financial amount, a denomination. When it's used of us, it represents any gift that he's given to us. So you'll see in 1 Peter chapter 4, it says, each one of us has received a special gift. Isn't that cool? Every single one of us, when you come to Christ, in the package, you get this special gift. Some of us more, some of you, number of gifts, but all of us, some measure of a gift that this group needs. So employ it in serving one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. I made you uniquely with value that others must have. Don't clutch to it. Don't hide it. Don't spend it on yourself. Invest it in the lives of others. Find passions and those to love. Don't worry about getting it right. I'm not keeping score. I just want you to go out there amongst others and risk discovering what I've given you and then give it away. Your gift was given to you for others' benefit. It doesn't work for you to spend it on you. It's garish. It becomes obvious. It's embarrassing. It's strident. It's foolish. It's noisy when this gift is spent for your adulation, success, or promotion, or proving. It's a gift that was meant to give away. It was never so you could compare with others or prove that you are enough or that you match up or that you're worthy of being loved. This was already settled long ago at an empty tomb. Your privilege is to give your unique gifts away in love. Oh gosh, and that's why we're doing this morning. It takes well-reasoned trust of Christ's integrity for you to live this way. And many, 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 many spend a lifetime missing this. I'm going to take a look at two different extremes, two ends of the continuum of those, one who doesn't get this at all and one who gets it utterly. For the first one, I think I told you to turn, if you haven't, to Luke 19. In Luke 19, and I pick Luke instead of the Matthew passage because just because he uses the word handkerchief, and it gives me a picture of how it looks. So it's this man who has gone away for a while, and he has all these possessions. He's wealthy. He's a master, and he is ferreting them out amongst his servants. And he's giving some this, some that. And he uses the word mina. It's the same word for talents. And he says in verse 20 of that chapter 19 in Luke, another came saying, Master, hey, here's your mina. I kept it put in a handkerchief because I was afraid of you. I was afraid of you because I know you to be an exacting man. And you take what you do not lay down, and you reap what you do not sow. Tell me, what is true about how this person sees his master? Raise your hand. What's true about how this person sees his master? Yes.
He is afraid of
him. He is uber afraid of him. Yes. He sees him as cruel. Yes, Jim. He sees him as exploitive, unfair. He puts demands on you. That's how he feels about this. And by the way, he's just using a parallel of how people see the Father. How many people see the Father. How else? How does he see him?
Takes more than he gives.
That this master is going to take more than he gives. What else? Yes. Unforgiving. Teddy, quietly, without raising his hand, shares unforgiving and
impersonal.
Impersonal. Thanks. What else? It's like he's owed something. Incredibly fearful. He's got this guarded relationship. See, every single one of us, when we come to Christ, we get something like this, a talent. Not the ability to run fast, but something of great value. Something of incredible value that you get that somebody doesn't have in exactly the same way, and I need it. God says, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to match all this up in this body. And he does it in communities, and he places us sovereignly and perfectly before the world began so that certain gifts get brought into certain communities, not just this mass gifting, but there's something about this that some of you might need. But let's say I've gotten hurt. And let's say that I feel shame. And let's say that I don't feel like I match up or that I'm enough. And that maybe this coin or that possession given to me is my way that I think that you will love me. And maybe I've gotten wounded when I tried to actually give this thing away. What will I do? I'll put it in a handkerchief, and I will know exactly where it is, and I will only bring it out for me, and I will stop trying to share it, because I just think, God, you will not have my back. You, when I try to do it, I'm the one who's left holding the bag. I get hurt. Nobody cares. Nobody gets it. They use me. God, I don't think you've had my back. I don't think you've protected me. I don't think you know how to take care of me. I love you. I know I'm going to heaven. I know you love me, and I know you'll make it work out. But, man, I am sure not going to invest this thing again, at least not the way I did before, not with such passion. Most of the time, I'm going to hide it. I just described a lot of people. I just described John Lynch often. So fragile, so afraid, so insecure, so scared to dare risk giving away something when I could spend it myself and maybe you would love me for doing it. There's another guy. We read about him last week. And this became my anthem It's in Acts. Again, go back there, if you will, to Acts 20:24. 2 weeks ago when I spoke, I talked about this astonishing statement. Think of just exactly how opposite it is of what we just heard in Luke. In 20:24, Paul says, look, I don't consider my life of any account as dear to myself. He's not saying I just don't care about life. I care about life immensely. I love stuff. I love great food. I love rest. I love play. But I'm not worried about what's going to happen to me. I don't even think about it. God takes care of that. My life is not dear to myself in trying to jack up my stock or trying to be elevated or anything else. He says, I don't consider my life of any account as dear to myself except that I get to do this. I want to finish my course in the ministry which I received from my sweet Lord Jesus to testify solemnly of the gospel of the grace of God. I just want to make sure I get to do that. Of everything else, including my wife, my kids, my everything else, this is what drives me. Tell me what's true about how this person sees his master. Raise your hand. Who's? Are we just not doing the hand-raising thing now? Oh, I've been here for a few years now. I'm beyond that. No, you raise your hand. Yes, thank you for that half hand that you did right there. Yeah. He gives abundantly. He sees him as someone who gives abundantly. So he doesn't have to worry. Yes. He loves me unconditionally. So I don't even have to think about me. What else? Yes. Oh, he sees it as the ultimate joy to get to serve him. What else? Yes. He meets all my needs. So I'm not gonna be the one who's scratching and clawing for my needs.
His testimony is validated by him becoming less so Jesus can become more.
His testimony is validated so that he can become less so that Jesus can become more in people's eyes. What else? Say that again. He's generous. He knows that he is generous. Paul says, I love my life, but I don't have to consider it as so dear to myself that I would clutch to my rights. He's got me covered. So the one thing I want to do in my life is tell others about him. What an incredibly beautiful opposite picture. Now, why does sun make wax melt and harden clay? I don't know. I just do not know. And listen so carefully to me, because I'm not sure I've always believed this. I do believe this at any time on this journey, if we want, I can move from that person in Luke 19 to this person in Acts. I can have this relationship. My direction and bent can absolutely change. And it all depends upon what you believe about the integrity, character, and faithfulness of God in you. It's exactly what we just answered. In how I think he will treat me in my daily life. You know what's fascinating? I was talking to Mark Huey yesterday, a couple days ago at lunch. It's interesting, the mature, they live out of Acts 20:24, even though they've experienced so much of the same pain and tribulation and loss and confusion and wounding as everybody else. It's not because they've had an easier life that they find themselves, say, in Acts 24. Paul was floating around on a plank of wood. It's just that the mature have learned to not blame God for the results of the fall. And so they don't ever use it as an evidence or an excuse or a reason that they would hide their talents. The mature or the immature are self-entitled. They presume the good which happens to them is a privilege or a right. The immature ignore that he is protecting them from themselves all the time. The immature never think of what they visibly are being protected from and what invisible hands are moving for their good all the time. The immature blame God for what he did not cause. The immature give little credit to God for what they can see that he has caused. The immature see hard times only as bad, and they learn little. The immature, they easily get angered at God. How could you? Why did you? The immature are easily afraid of God for what they imagine he's going to do to them. Those are the immature, and so they are like the one in Acts 19, very afraid, because I love you, I know you love me, I know I'm going to go to heaven, I know I'm going to spend eternity with you, and you're going to be a much better God then. But right now, I don't trust you with what's most precious to me. Now the mature, and this obviously is a sliding scale. Sometimes I feel like I'm the mature. Sometimes I feel like I'm in the immature. But the mature, by and large, do not call the visibly good. They don't ever call it coincidence. The mature glorify God for what could have and hasn't happened. The mature search for evidence of the supernatural coming during their hardest seasons. They are studying the landscape and saying, this doesn't look good or feel good right now, but I'm watching carefully to see what you're doing good, because I know you never waste a moment with me. You never make a mistake regarding me. And even this hard season right now, you're doing something magnificent. Man, I'm having a hard time seeing it, but I am looking. The mature have the ability to interpret what God is doing without presuming from a filter of shame or blame or retribution or lack of care or God's inability. The mature are hugely able to distinguish between the works of God and the results of the fall. The mature never take for granted the invisible daily provision of God. The mature discover that there isn't some level of health that they must attain to before they can give their lives away. The mature cannot get over what was done for them by Jesus. It never gets old. It never gets tired. They can't get over it. They just go, why? Why did it happen to me? Why did the love of God fall upon me? Why could this happen to John Lynch? The one who used to swear with every vile word he could, his name. How did I get you, Jesus? Why would you do this? And why would you give me a life beyond telling? I can't get over it. I just can't get over it. The mature have settled that he is not out to get them. The mature have understood that it's not a competition. The concept of getting angry at God is really curious to them. The mature are not afraid of what he might do to them in a moment of too much caffeine. The immature are afraid to screw up. They are rarely creative. They just do what's expected of them. Here, you gave me a mina, I give you a mina back. The mature, they're like a swashbuckling drunk at a party. They try 33 things, and if 7 work, it's been a good season. So here you and I are. Jesus, can I trust you with me? I know what I did with my talent. I know where I put it. And I what if, with what I risk, with the dreams that I place in front of you, with the life which will follow if I dare to try it out, with what love might look like in my world? Have you proven, will you be there to catch me if I've gotten it wrong or if I'm too immature to see it right? Can I believe that you're for me, that you're able to catch me, that you'll pick me up and renew me and refresh me and defend me and empower me if I try to hear your voice mixed with my new desires and nature? Because I'm, gosh, I want to live that way. And then maybe next you start to imagine a world where you do more than exist, do more than survive, do more than clutch. You start to risk faith to generously give away what you've been given. You start small because you don't know what you're doing, only that you must start somewhere. There's really, not everybody can guide you on this. There's not, spiritual gift inventories, they always confuse me more than help. I just look around each day until need and opportunity matches with my new heart. But here's what has to happen. I have to see through different eyes. I have to ask the hard question. So what if there is no guarantee that I will financially succeed if I start a business entrusted to the Lord? What if there's no guarantee that when I begin a family that all of them will outlive me? Because there is none. What if I have no promise that this church that I have loved so much and given my life to, that it will always prosper the way I'd hoped it would? What if I give up my practice to go into the world to share the gospel and I become horribly sick from living amongst the people I came to love? And what I have to do in turn is look at the Word and let it flood me. I'm just going to give these in rapid fire. I have to let His integrity flood over me so that I don't get duped by those questions. Because those questions should be answered if I'm a Christian by, well, it shouldn't happen to you. And it will. It may. And what I have to know is this. Jesus will never play me. Jesus will never fail me. Jesus will not ignore me or leave me hanging. He will not let me end up playing the fool. He will reveal Himself to me in intimacy I could not know otherwise. He is stunningly brave for me. He is endlessly for me. He fights all enemies for me all the time. He died for me when I wanted Him dead. He bears my shame continually and stands in front of it. He is redeeming, restoring, and reworking what has failed in me all the time. He always has something more important than the win. He is doing something magical in me amidst all of the loss. He's not using my misfortune to teach me some lesson. He's always vindicating the risk of my trust, and He always has my back for any loss I might incur. And He always, always, always stays right next to me every single moment saying, I so got this, I so got this. It can be bundled into that statement of Hebrews 13:5. Hey, John, I will never leave you and I will never forsake you. Not only will I not ever step away for a moment and forget where you are or be in a different location, I will always be right where you are. And I will never get tired of you. I will never lose interest in you. I will never consider you second place. I will never, ever, ever stop having you be my primary dream. So this faith that we're talking about, it's not static, huh? Do you know what I mean by that? Once you have it, it doesn't stay forever necessarily, and if you lose it, it doesn't have to be that way forever. It's not static. I've been in this pulpit on McDowell, at Madison, here. I've been a cowering, hold-up unbeliever preaching from this pulpit at times. There have been things along the way that have broken my heart, and it has rocked me, and I have not said it at times. I just go on. My faith has been memorial and dormant at times. I can still perform. I can still use hand gestures by memory. I could still remember the truth of what I believe. See, I was 27 years old in 79, I've known Jesus is real. That's never been a question. But oh my gosh, if you could see how many times I have wrapped up that talent and put it back again and buried it. So what draws out and woos out my faith? You know what doesn't? Good fortune, prosperity, or success. Isn't that interesting? I would have thought those things, and they do, they make me feel great. I feel great when I do well, when people like me, and all that. It just doesn't build up my faith. Makes me feel good. Makes me happy, and I treat Stacy better. But it doesn't build up my faith. Faith, this very real thing, is apparently built by experiencing Him protecting and restoring me amidst the ruins. Experiencing His presence when no one else can get through. That builds my faith, of believing what He is redeeming in the not seen. Remember Hebrews 11:1, the things not seen. When I finally come to the grips with, well, I'm going to believe that. That's what faith is. It's not seen yet. So I'm going to believe that there is a yet and it will happen. Oh my gosh. Believing that He is redeeming the damage that He did not cause. Learning to enjoy Him and rest in His presence in the not yet. Reading His Word and trusting what you read. Romans 10:17, so faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of Christ. Those things build up my faith. You know what else He says builds up my faith is you. Really spends a lot of time talking about how you build up my faith, and I build up your faith, and we build up each other's faith. How sacredly important. He says it so often. Remember we read it in Romans 1:12 and 1 Thessalonians 1:3 and 1 Thessalonians 3:2. Throughout this series, I want you to keep looking at it. You encourage me with your faith. Now, usually I would tell you, how do we do this? Because you know I speak all the time about identity in Christ and grace, and you would think that I would say, well, it's by telling you who you are in Christ and how Christ loves you. And that is incredible. And you never stop doing that with each other. But that isn't what He's saying builds up my faith. He's saying it's your faith that builds up my faith. So I'm dependent upon Quinn to have faith. That's not easy. I feel like I need to go elsewhere. I know. So this guy builds up my faith. Tim Murray. Didn't always. Oh my gosh, was he a piece of work. But over time, Tim and my relationship, Tim builds up my faith. This man right here builds up my faith. This woman brought me a piece of pie the other night. She didn't build up my faith at all, but gosh, was it good. Human beings, I'm stuck. We're stuck with this fragile reality. Now, let me tell you what doesn't build up my faith. Because this sounds so... It sounds like, well, then what I need to do is this. You know what? Your bragging does not build up my faith. Your easy answers do not build up my faith. Your stories that always end up with God doing incredible things through you or to you does not build up my faith. It makes me want to hide from you. Your slogans do not build up my faith. You know, when God closes a door, He takes a shutter and... Well, you go down the... Sometimes there'll be a hole in the roof and you can just take a... I don't know, there's something in there, but He'll do it. Count on Him, you know? He never makes something so big that he... Whew. I get so weary. Don't ever tell me those things. I just look at you and go, oh, I can't trust you, can I? Listen to what he's saying. In 1 Thessalonians 5:11, when he says, we need to build each other up, it's because I got torn down. In 1 Thessalonians 3:2, when he says, you must strengthen each other, we're sending Timothy a strength, it's because you've been weakened. When he wants us to encourage, it's because I have been discouraged. This is so sacred, you guys. This is where we have to grow up as a body together. This is where you have to be so wise, not to preach, but to woo out, to draw out, to stand with. How does your faith not make me feel more ashamed and more condemned and beat up, but instead it's you saying to me, it's Tim saying, I know who you are, John, and we've done this thing together, and I'm still believing this, John. You're not alone. It's Joe saying, I'm still here, kid. I still got you. This Jesus is still yours. I will stand and carry your shield until you can carry yours again. And God builds me up. I need those who are learning that art of loving in such a way as to not lecture me or tell me those verses that I should be, but am not. I need artists who can come in and draw my heart out into who they know I am by sharing to me that they're still doing it. This is the magic of the body of Christ. This is why we get together, by the way. Oh, by the way, the gifts of the Spirit that are given to you, that talent, it says in Romans 11:29, it's irrevocable. You can't hide it and forget where it is. He knows exactly where it is. And it is never revocable. No matter what you do, no matter how much you fail, no matter how selfish you have been or self-centered or immature, he says, you still got it, kid. And at any time you want, you get to use it. I will never let it be taken from you. I will never let it lose its power. It is here and it is ready for you. I gave it to you and I will not take it back any more than I can take back your salvation. So today, at the start of this journey, in this series, are you trustworthy, God? Have you taken care of me? Have you had my back? Have you protected me? Have you brought me through the storm? Are you bringing me through the storm? Can I see evidences of that? Have you given me something to share? Is it going to cost me to share it? Yes. Is the life produced in me and others worth the risk? Will I be protected if I choose wrongly? Yes. Will you catch me if I fall? Yes. Then I'm beginning the new journey today. Or maybe I'm walking back out onto the path of an old journey that I had abandoned. You know, it's interesting. It says he will never leave you and he will never forsake you. The reason he can say that is because he took the hit of your forsakenness. He says to me, I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. But the same one saying it is the one who cries out on the cross, my Father, why would you forsake me? Because he took all of the cost and all of the pain and all of the penalty and all the desperate isolation and all of the loneliness and all the despair because he took it on himself. The one who took it on himself can say, you will never be forsaken. I got you. Let's go worship him at this table.